the UCR podcast.
Well, I know we've got some Rush fans out there in the universe listening to this podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. And as we talk about in today's interview, the journey you take when you become a Rush fan is quite an interesting one. And from where I'm sitting, the twists and turns on that trip never come to a close, which is what's great about exploring the group and their music. Daniel Buckspan is the author of a new book called Rush and 2112, 50 Years, and he takes a deep dive into the history behind the band's legendary fourth album, which was indeed released 50 years ago in 1976. He talked to a number of people from inside the circle and also did a heavy amount of research to really expand the reader's fly-on-the-wall perspective for the time period. And there's some great stories and quotes from Geddy, Alex, and Neil in this book. We dig into a number of Rush-related topics outside of 2112, including Daniel's thoughts on some of the more quote-unquote controversial periods of the band's music, how he feels about the upcoming remix of Grace Under Pressure, and a lot more. We also discuss his upcoming book near the end of this conversation, which is about the history of the Big Four, Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, and Slayer. You can look for that in November. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, you're in luck because we are big Rush fans at Ultimate Classic Rock and have written a lot about the band over the years. And with the upcoming reunion tour, something tells me we're going to be writing about them even more as 2026 continues. The new book, Rush and 2112, 50 Years, is available now wherever you get your books, and I highly recommend it. Here is our conversation with Daniel Buckspan. Thank you for taking some time here to talk about the book. And obviously, where I'll start is Rush is something you've been thinking about professionally a good amount, especially in recent years with your book, Rush at 50. That came out in 2024, celebrating the band's 50th anniversary. And now you have this new book, Rush and 2112, 50 years. And as a fellow fan, I understand it, but why do you think that 2112 is such an important album for Rush and also classic rock overall?
Well, you know, I mean, for the band, it was really, it was their fourth album. You know, they had had three already, but 2112 was, you know, in my opinion, really the arrival point. If you want to talk about artistically, it was really the record where, you know, they really got all their ducks in a row, so to speak. I love those first three records. You will never hear me say a bad word about those first three records. But each of them, you know, had a little filler or maybe a couple of ideas that didn't totally come together, you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
2112, there is not a second of filler anywhere on that record. You cannot find it. It is not there. And, famously, Mercury, the label, wanted a single from them. The label was saying, like, you know, we may drop you if we don't get a hit record out of this one. They don't do that. Rush is not a band that could just consciously manufacture a single. So instead, they're like, you know, basically, you know, screw you, we're going to do what we want. And they make this record. And the first song is 20 minutes long. And I have been saying that was the single. And it's the world's longest single at 20 and a half minutes. But it did for them exactly what a single was supposed to do. It, you know, opened the door for them. It was their breakthrough. And it made everything possible that came after. And they did it by violating every rule that the music industry lives by.
Which becomes really, if people hadn't already picked up on that, that was kind of a Rush trademark of just doing that, breaking the rules, violating the rules. How do you discover Rush yourself, and when did you see Rush for the first time?
The discovery, I guess, was like kind of early on. The first time I knew I was hearing Rush, I saw them on MTV when I was a young teenager, and it was the video for Distant Early Warning, which was cool, and I liked it, but it wasn't enough to, like, you know, draw me right in. Then I heard the guitar solo to Free Will, and that was it. And here we are many decades later, and that was all it took, really. I didn't actually see them until 1994 on the Counterparts tour. But, I mean, it was like one of the best sounding concerts I've ever been to. Obviously, you know, the playing, you can't fault that at all. And it was great, and it was wonderful to be able to see them. But, you know, you're supposed to see them live, you know, and it was great to finally be able to see them do it all in real time. That was great.
Yeah, we saw the band really kind of in similar eras, and you write about this in the book, but my first show was in 1996 on the Test for Echo tour, which was notable, of course, for a number of reasons, including fans getting to see Rush play the entire 2112 suite, which was awesome. So when I think of 2112, even though my love for Rush goes back further than, we'll say, the mid-90s, that's kind of one of the things I think about, and I really appreciate that I got to see that tour. So what's kind of the journey you yourself, the personal journey that you took with 2112? And if we look at that, what are kind of your memories of diving into that record for the first time? How does that happen?
Probably the best way to describe it is, you know, I hear the guitar solo to Free Will, I go nuts and just bought everything. And, you know, basically from that point forward, I was just having this kind of like orgy of listening to every Rush album. And, you know, and I mean, I have to be honest with you, I cannot remember the very first time I heard 2112, because I, like I said, I was basically listening to everything. And, but I mean, you know, I obviously came back to it many times. And, you know, in the decades that have passed, you know, it's really held up and it's really stood out. I love most of their records. I don't really have like a specific era that I, you know, a lot of people gravitate towards a specific era of the band. But I really love pretty much everything they, I mean, there's a couple of records I'm not crazy about, but for the most part, I just love it all. And, you know, to me, 2112 is just such a strong album, and it's like, it's such a statement, you know, of, you know, you cannot peg us. You cannot nail us down. And every record we do is going to, you know, we're going to be pushing, we're going to be progressing. That was really the statement of that record, is like, this is who we are. This is what we sound like, take it or leave it. And I feel like that really comes through when you listen to it. Like there's a defiance to it emotionally that you can sort of feel coming off of the music, which is not necessarily the case on their other records. Like that one though, specifically, you really feel like, wow, you know, these guys really have something to say. And they're really like, you know, they're leaving it all on the field with this one. They've put all their chips on this. You know, and I have to say that I think that's probably why it connected as well as it did. And that's probably why it resonated. It's, you know, when you, it's, you know, it's the sound of a band kind of fighting for their lives and fighting for their career. But it worked. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Isn't it funny? Because you've written a number of books, Daniel. So often, we know as music fans, so often when bands are really up against the wall like that is when they make some of their best records. And you and I could go through a huge stack of bands that did that with certain records. But it's really fascinating. I guess it's really kind of the same thing just as life in general, that, you know, when you're really up against it, that's when the pressure seems to pay off somehow. And it's Rush, I think you could probably say that that pressure in other ways paid off in interesting ways throughout their career, right?
Yeah, you know, 2112, the way they characterize it is, you know, that's the record that won us our artistic independence, our creative independence. And it was really from that point forward that they, you know, they really started changing with every record stylistically. And, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, if they hit something successful and, you know, they make an album and it resonates, they will be very tempted to make the next album exactly the same. So, you know, I mean, maybe a lot of people were expecting, you know, 2113 to be the next record. But they really, every record was a big step forward. And, you know, I mean, you know, obviously there are some similarities that you hear throughout the catalog, and there is a through line. But those records are very different from each other. You know, if you do 2112 to Farewell to Kings to Hemispheres, they really don't sound alike. And, you know, but people refer to that as like, those are their prog albums. And I don't even really consider 2112 to be a prog album, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I mean, there's prog stuff about it. But to me, Hemispheres is like the prog record. And then they got sick of it and moved on with the next record, you know. But, I mean, what 2112 really established for them is we are going to do what we want to do. And you may not like some of it. We don't know. But we know what we're doing. This is what we want to pursue. And please stay out of our way.
It's almost like they really underlined with that album, this is, we are going to do what we want to do. It's like you can make the case that they were already doing that with those first three records. And then you talk about getting to see the band for the first time on the Counterparts tour. If you look at the, there were people that were not happy with the rapping on the Roll of the Bones album. There were people that were not happy with the grunge, the quote unquote grunge sound on Counterparts. There's still entire swaths of people that hate the quote unquote 80s synthesizer records. So these guys were and have been just admirably steadfast when it comes to following their muse, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard every kind of accusation hurled at them. I've heard, you know, I mean, I've heard everything, you know, you talked about, you know, of course, the worst tragedy of all time, you know, which is, you know, 10 seconds of rapping on Roll the Bones, you know, which to me, I have never seen people overreact like that in my life, ever. That was amazing. I've never seen anything like that. You know, and to this day, there are still fans who are like, man, why did they do that? Like still now at this minute, you know, but you know, people are really sensitive to however they change and whatever they do next. And I mean, like, I don't know if you've been like, you know, paying attention to any of the response to the, you know, the Terry Brown remix of Grace Under Pressure. And I mean, I am just seeing a lot of people there who are just like, you can't touch it. You can't touch anything. How could, don't do that. Don't do that to our baby. There's a lot of that kind of thing. So I mean, anything the band does that's sort of new and is sort of a step away from what people are used to, there's going to be like a big reaction to that, negative and positive. But then some years pass and you look back and like, oh, that all makes sense. These were all natural steps in everything they did. And, you know, I mean, like that, the 90s period that we're talking about, I honestly, I think is probably the weakest part of their catalog, if I had to say. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, you look back now and you listen back to all those records. And they hold up a lot better, you know, certainly than I reacted to them at the time. Like I really don't like Hold Your Fire, for example, that, which is 80s, I know.
Sure.
But it's just too polished. I have a lot of problems with it. But when I did Rush at 50, I went back and listened to the entire catalog. And, you know, even that album and, you know, Roll the Bones, you know, ones that I was not crazy about, I still had to, you know, kind of concede like, well, I mean, the songwriting is there and the playing is there. You know, just they took it all in a direction that is maybe not necessarily for me. But, you can't deny, you know, with any of those records that these are just the most elite musicians in the world. And they're not going to just phone in some crap to meet a contractual obligation. It matters to them. And even if I didn't care for, you know, Hold Your Fire, it mattered to them at the time that it came out the way that it did and that it sounds the way it does. And, you know, now you put it on, you know, decades later and, you know, I mean, it's still not my favorite Rush album, but it's hard for me to see what the problem was at the same time, you know.
It all kind of ultimately holds up. The shortest way to say all that is like it ultimately all holds up under the lens of what Rush is. As you were saying all that, kind of what I think of is that like there's some records from the early part of the 90s especially, and 1990 specifically in some cases, that just sound so glossy and so plastic. But like when I listen to the Roll of the Bones album, and the song that I was thinking of as you were talking specifically was Dreamline, like that sounds like Rush to me. It's like there's some stuff that, to your point, you go back to it now from any band and you're like, man, not only does that not sound like the band or artist, but that just sounds terrible. And so they had an interesting knack, I think, for the most part. We can't say 100%, but for the most part, they had an interesting knack for kind of fitting into different decades and different eras of what was happening with music, without coming off sounding so horribly dated in the process. And again, I kind of go back to Dreamline. When I think of Dreamline and how that song sounds, like, it's got a sound that still kind of sounds kind of cool and futuristic even now.
Yeah, 100%. There's good stuff all over that record. The only reason anyone thinks of Roll the Bones as like some kind of, you know, atrocity in their catalog is, again, because they did 10 seconds of rapping on one song.
Yeah.
And there are good tunes all over that record. It's a good record. And again, when I was doing the whole listen back to everything thing, you know, it didn't make me like the song Roll the Bones anymore, but I recognized, like, no, that needs to be there. That's part of the whole record. And if it was not there, like, you know, if I just skipped it, as I guess a lot of people probably do, and listened only to the remaining 9 songs, something's off. Like, something is missing. So, you know, it's, again, you may not necessarily like the particular turn they took or whatever, but they were never copying anybody, certainly. And, you know what I mean? Even when they did, you know, take stuff like that, or, you know, when it was a lot more keyboard heavy in the 80s, I don't think they were copying anybody. And I don't think that they were trying to, like, you know, be part of a trend or anything like that. You know, I mean, like the keyboard stuff, I think they saw what was going on around them with New Wave. And they were like, that's interesting. I wonder what we could do with that. And they, you know, they kind of tried it on for size and, you know, took it out for a spin and then moved on, you know. And but they never at any point were anything other than Rush doing it. And at no time did you ever see them come out dressed like, you know, Flock of Seagulls saying, we're a new wave band now. They were always Rush.
Yeah.
Just the zigs and zags were different.
For sure. And I want to dig back in with 2112, but since you mentioned the Grace Under Pressure remix, what you've heard of it so far, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely fucking love it. pardon my French.
No, please.
No, I think it's great. I never really disliked the original mix. I always liked that album. I always thought it was good. But I love what Terry Brown did with the remix. I'm glad that, you know, the box set that's coming out will have both the original mix and the remix.
Exactly. So they're not taking it away, which is one point, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I loved the original mix of Vapor Trails.
Yeah, same.
I thought I was kind of alone in the world on that one. And I would even go further and say that is their grunge album, not Counterparts.
Yeah.
Just, you know, because it's just like so grim and overdriven and moody. Anyway, you know, it's a lot more, you know, on the darker side, you know, and obviously, understandably so, you know. I was devastated when they remixed it. I understand the band didn't like how it came out, and obviously it's their record and they can do what they want with it and they have the right to remix it if they want to. I just wish they had kept the original out there, but I had to be told it sounds bad. You know, like I loved it when I first heard it, and it wasn't until like months after it came out that I started hearing people saying like, I can't listen to that record, man. It sounds terrible. And I was like, am I on Mars? I don't know. What are you talking about? You know, I felt like I was in an alternate universe or something.
Rush fans are generally pretty well informed, and you got to talk to some folks with direct ties to the 2112 album and the band's overall legacy. You mentioned Terry Brown, for example, who co-produced 2112. You spoke with Terry, Hugh Syme, who did the album artwork, and of course, Donna Halper, who played a pivotal role in exposing the band's music to American audiences. With each of those folks, how did that kind of perhaps deepen your understanding of the 2112 album and perhaps reveal things that you were unaware of, or at the very least, sharpen certain aspects in a way that made more sense?
Well, you know, it was really, you know, I mean, I had already spoken to Hugh and Donna on Rush at 50.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I already, there was something already like a little established there. So, the person I really learned the most from, was probably Terry. Because you know the way he characterized, you know, there's all this lore around the making of 2112, you know, that it was their make or break moment. The label was going to drop them, et cetera, et cetera. He said he was like kind of blissfully unaware of most of that. And when they came into the studio to record, he said the whole thing was just a lot of fun from start to finish. And it was, you know, and it was collaborative and it was really not a heavy atmosphere at all. You know, I mean, he, I think the quote was like, all those records were really fun to make. And, you know, when you put on 2112, I don't know if the first word that comes to mind for you is fun. You know, I don't know necessarily that that's the first thing I would think of. But, you know, the way he described the whole process and the way everything came together, there was a lot more spontaneity to it than you might think. Certainly they came in really prepared with most of the music written and the arrangements and everything. But the way they worked, there was just always room for Terry to be like, yeah, but how about this or how about this? And they really liked that and they really responded to that. And they were really open to, they didn't come in there with these finished demos where they're like, that's the song, that's how it is, end of story. They were really open to any suggestions. You know, when they were recording Tears, Hugh Syme happened to be at the studio while that was happening. And he mentioned something offhand like, oh, you know, maybe there'd be a nice like flute there or something. And so Terry goes, why don't you work up a Mellotron arrangement and we'll record it? Hmm. And everyone was like, that's great. So he disappears for a couple of hours, writes something, comes back, records it, and they all loved it. There was no, Hugh, maybe try this, or Hugh, that's not close to what we wanted. They were very open to other people's ideas, you know, assuming, you know, obviously it was the right ideas. I didn't know that there was like really that level of spontaneity in what they did. I really expected, I expected to see diagrams, you know,
yep.
You know, but I mean, one thing I've heard over and over again from people I've interviewed who worked with them was just that they weren't like that. They weren't these like really serious, heavy, you know, I mean, obviously Neil could be a little intense and was not like this outgoing social guy by any means, but that the atmosphere around them was never oppressive. And most of the people I talked to who worked with them said they were all really funny. And one of their sound engineers even used the term gut-bustingly funny. And the working with the three of them was like working with the Three Stooges. And, you know, I think to a lot of people, that's just not how they perceive the band at all. I think they, you know, perceive them very, you know, like they're these, you know, really studied guys in lab coats, you know, there's all that, you know,
and they're just
not like that. And, you know, and they have a sense of humor and they like jokes and, you know, all that stuff. You know, but beyond that, I mean, what I really got from everyone I talked to, you know, cause everyone I talked to was really cool. And all of them, just everything that they had to say about those guys was they were just really easy to work with. They were very respectful of everyone around them. And like they would make a point if they were on tour of learning the first names of everyone on the crew and acknowledging them as they passed them in the hallway. You know, I am sure you have heard horror stories how most musicians treat their crew. And they just weren't like that. And, you know, I mean, there was one guy I interviewed, you know, when I asked him if he wanted to be interviewed for the first book, he was like, you know, I really don't do interviews anymore. I've kind of said everything I have to say, but for those guys, I'll do it. And I feel like the people they've surrounded themselves with, who are all these like incredibly decent, down-to-earth people, really speaks well of the band. And that's really been my takeaway the whole time I've been writing about them is, you know, obviously they were very serious about the music. They wanted it to turn out a certain way. That was of the utmost importance to them. But they weren't Robert Fripp, you know.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
As you lay out in the book, 2112 is frequently tagged as a concept album, an easy assumption. And in the 70s, certainly a time that concept albums were quite welcome. You can understand why that maybe sort of was allowed to perpetuate and it kind of played in their favor. Do you think it harmed the legacy of this album at all, or at the very least, the accessibility of it for music fans over the years?
No, everyone seems to be totally fine with the fact that, I mean, I personally don't consider it a concept album because only one side has a concept. So it's like 50% of a concept album, maybe. But no, I mean, it's stuff like that. And, you know, like the very long songs and, you know, all the things that they've done that could be called progressive might maybe harm some other band. Like there might be some other band that might get harmed by the association with that kind of a description, but it never hurt them at all. And I mean, if anything, there are people who are like, why don't they do any more concept songs? Why don't they do that? You know, and they finally did a full concept album with Clockwork Angels.
Yeah.
But I don't think a lot of people are aware that that's a concept album. 2112, I think, is the one that people will talk about as that's their concept album.
Well, as we've mentioned, you have a number of other books, and upcoming, you have a book about heavy metal's Big Four, Metallica, yep, Megadeth, Anthrax, and Slayer, and that's out, I believe, in November. What can, yes, folks kind of look forward to with that one?
That is kind of my bucket list book that I've wanted to write since I was 18 and was just completely balls deep in those bands. and that was my whole that was my whole life, was being in that subculture, and I've wanted to do something about those bands since forever. But what I found, you know, it's about the four of them, kind of, you know, I wouldn't say they came up together necessarily, but you know, they have a kind of an intertwined history and have been in each other's orbit the whole time. And I thought it was, you know, just a really interesting way of approaching it by talking about it that way, and how, you know, it eventually led to Clash of the Titans and then eventually leads to the Big Four concerts. And also just sort of tracking, you know, them all starting out in, you know, like 1981. In Megadeth's case, it's 1983. And, you know, just there are a lot of horror stories about touring bands just starting out, and these guys played in like absolutely the shittiest venues you can possibly imagine just starting out. It, you know what I mean, there's all this stuff about like Slayer's first tour was they went around in Tom Araya's Camaro with a U-Haul hitch attached to the back of it, and like they played at this one club in Boston that like a car had plowed into the front of it. And it was a little boarded up, but no one had really fixed it or anything. But they played there anyway. Like, I mean, there was just a lot of stuff that was like, wow, the beginnings that these guys had were as low rent as possible. Like, you know, really a lot of squalor, I think you could say, was involved. And, you know, to go from that within 10 years to, you know, Metallica releasing one of the highest selling albums of all time, that's pretty incredible. And then I also spend a chapter on, you know, how the whole thing sort of fell apart in the 90s as music changed. And, but, you know, this, they still kept going through all of that. And, you know, to me, it's, if there, I feel like if there's any sort of through line in my books, it's about all these bands who, you know, they did what they wanted to do. They stuck to their guns. The fans were always with them. And the thing that they really had to negotiate that was a problem most of the time was the music business.
Yeah.
And MTV and the intermediaries and people who were not really about the music. Because when, you know, when Donna Halper plays Working Man on WMMS in Cleveland in 1974, they didn't even have a label. Yeah. They had put the record out themselves. But when people, you know, regular record buying people like you and me heard it, they just immediately responded to it. And I have sort of come to believe that what the music industry does is get in the way of the connection between fans and bands. And the less they're involved, the more direct the connection is going to be. You know, I mean, Iron Maiden played in Poland in 1984 when, you know, nobody was playing there. And they were very much about, we just want a direct line to our fans. And to me, that's why they're still here. That's why we're still talking about them, is they never lost sight of that.
Yeah.
And they never really cared about the music business at all. And I can say that about, I think, all of these bands that I've written about, is they, it was about primarily just people loved the music. And that's all the focus ever should have been on. And as long as there was that connection uninterrupted, it was all good.
Well, good sir, Daniel, it was a lot of fun talking to you about this book, Rush and 2112, 50 years. It's incredibly well-researched. I love seeing, for example, being here in Cleveland, I love seeing you know, an article from the Cleveland Plain Dealer in 1976 among the many various sources. And I think you dug out some really interesting stuff, not only from the folks that you talked to, but some of the other stuff that you sourced, you know, that Alex, Getty, and Neil have said about this record over the years. And I think it's a must-have for fellow fans out there. So thanks for taking some time to talk about this today.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for having me. And I think I may have cited you in one of my books once.
It's possible, yeah.
Yeah, I recognize your name. So, and I hit Ultimate Classic Rock a lot. So you may already have, you know, a place of honor in my citation somewhere. So
that's an honor.
I'm happy to return the favor, and I like your publication very much, and I rely on your publication. So this makes me very happy to do this.
Well, sir, we will talk more when the Big Four book is out, but for now, there's plenty for folks to dig into. And thanks again for the time, man. We'll connect again.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.